remember my oldest daughter's first birthday. There was a lot of commotion and many friends and family were there to celebrate. She had no idea what was happening. She's 15 now, but looking back at the pictures of her celebration, it's kind of funny. She probably received more presents than ever, even though she couldn't care less what they were. And people sang to her, but she joined in the singing because she didn't know it was for her. Now, my wife made a cake from scratch that was a giant ladybug. My daughter destroyed that cake. I'm pretty sure more cake was on her face than in her mouth. I'm also sure that we put a bib on her just to make us look like responsible parents, but that bib did nothing to prevent the mess that was happening. I remember thinking about that whole jamboree and wondering what someone who had no idea about our birthday customs or celebrations would think about all the silliness that we were experiencing. It would have to be a very strange experience for somebody who is a complete stranger to our birthday customs, seeing our silly hats, blowing the horns, singing the bizarre songs, and wearing food. Surely, they would have to wonder what everything meant. Why the hats or the songs? What's the meaning of the cake that no one eats but the baby wears? Why all this hoopla? Editor Mike Woodley points out that in every age and culture, people have developed ways of saying things by doing things. I mean, could you imagine a world without gestures and symbols? Think about what it would be like to have no such thing as a wave or a handshake for a greeting. What it would be like if there was no such thing as wedding rings or special songs or flags. A gestureless world without dances, salutes, or symbols would be bland at best and stripped of meaning at worst. Symbols, both symbolic objects and gestures, open up a level of reality for which non-symbolic speaking is inadequate. Thankfully, the Bible teaches in terms of these symbols, and Christians have been operating with these gestures for centuries. Now, I know what you might be thinking. You might say, well, I don't need symbols or gestures to express my faith and dedication to the Lord. I can get by with my Bible and brain and will be just fine. But all throughout the Bible, God used physical things and non-physical gestures to communicate his love and truth to us. When God wanted to express his love to Noah and all of creation, he did say it, but he also put a rainbow in the sky as a demonstration. When God wanted to display his glory, he said it, but he also directed his people to build an elaborate tabernacle. And when God wanted to show how awful sin was and how much forgiveness costs, he had his people pick one of their best sheep, bring it to the tabernacle, and sacrifice it. As harsh as that may sound, you can believe that no one ever left a worship service and said, I just don't get why God takes sin so seriously. You participated in it. You watched it. You felt it. You smelled it. The God we read in the Bible loves us and wants us to know him, not just know about him. Woodley goes on to point out that it's really the error of modernity to assume that we can grasp God without verbal analysis and clear thinking apart from deeper than rational symbols and actions and gestures. One of the most important symbolic celebrations that we discover in the Bible was the remembrance of Passover. Every year, the people of God would sojourn to Jerusalem to remember the story of how they were led out of Egypt from slavery by God in his wonderful love and power. The Passover meal commemorates how God came down and set them free, bringing his wrath on Pharaoh. And they celebrated by eating, drinking, telling stories, and enacting rituals. Mark 14, 12 through 16 records this. And on the first day of the unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover? And he sent two of his disciples and said to them, Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, and wherever he enters, say to the master of the house, The teacher says, Where is my guest room? Where may I eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. There prepare for us. And the disciples set out and went to the city and found it, just as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. Now the disciples did not understand fully what was taking place. They knew the elements of Passover, but they didn't realize that Jesus was the lamb that was to be sacrificed the next morning. Verses 22 through 25 says this, And as they were eating, he took bread, and after blessing it, broke it, and gave it to them and said, Take, this is my body. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he had gave it to them, and they all drank of it, and he said to them, This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. Jesus had foretold of his death at least three times up to this point, but his death was not a tragedy. If you've ever read Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, you would see how nearly everyone dies and almost all the deaths are considered a tragedy. They are tragedies because all the deaths are a result of plans gone awry. But Jesus' death isn't a tragedy. It all happens according to God's plan. Even in the darkest hour, a life in the hand of God is a remarkable plan. Because of this, we can look back every time we participate in communion of how Jesus took the symbolic tradition and radically recreated and fulfilled a new Passover that Christians have called the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion, or the Eucharist. This took place in part so that we can understand how God thinks and deals with sin. I like how Dorothy Sayers explains it. She says that God was executed by people painfully like us in a society very similar to our own by a corrupt church, a timid politician, and a fickle proletariat led by professional agitators. This week is often called Passion Week. Passion is a strange word. Mostly we use the word to convey something that we have a strong desire or feeling for, but the meaning is actually quite deeper. Passion entails suffering. To have passion for something means that you are willing to suffer for it. It's called Passion Week because Jesus was willing to suffer for us. A.J. Swadoba declares in his book, A Glorious Dark, "In the gospel stories, everyone fails. Everyone sins against Christ, even the best disciples, even the good guys. The celebration of Passover and now the Lord's Supper reminds us that God not only died because of us, but for us." Pastor Matt Woodley once again reminds us that the Lord's Supper is more than a ritual for the righteous, but it is the perfect meal for the sinner. With such beautiful simplicity and clarity, the Lord's Supper, communion, answers the question, what is God like? And for those who follow Jesus, the answer becomes so clear in Jesus' gesture at Passover to the cross. God is love. The one who is equal with God, the very form of God, the one who had more rights and more privileges than all of us combined, gave himself in love for us. We commemorate that love in the symbolic celebration of communion. So take time today to marinate in this truth. Don't be flippant. There's no greater love than this. As you think about this love, find a way to connect your life with his and live gratefully and thankfully for the one who paid it all. Be sure to make plans to attend Good Friday service at South Rock Christian Church at 7 o'clock, which will be a special time that we can focus on God's love expressed on the cross. Hope to see you then.